Yeah. Letting me introduce you.
So oh. Now recording and let me.
So I should put this.
That's the most comfortable. And then pocket.
So this is all ready to go. I don't do anything else. Well, I'm not going to do anything. This is all right.
I'm just going to, sorry.
That's fine.
Adjust it. More comfortable. Is that okay?
Yes.
All right.
All right, great. Wanted to say hello?
Hi,
good to see you.
We're going to go to lunch.
I'm looking forward to it.
It's more like a dinner for you on your time.
That's fine. Oh, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Very nice. Fabulous dinner. Thanks for coming. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Did you have a good evening?
Delightful. Thank you.
And Nicole Kurlander is going to introduce today's speaker and make a short announcement about next week's speaker. Thank you all for coming. So before I introduce Professor Renee, I just want to announce that next week, same time, same place, the Poverty Center will be hosting, I think it's the same place, yes, here in Andrews Conference Room, Fighting Child Poverty, Spending So Much, Getting So Little. Ron Haskins will be here. So we hope to see you all back next week. So for today, I have the honor to introduce Richard Murnane, who's Professor of Education and Economics at Harvard University. And Dick has written numerous articles, way more than I can enumerate here, on the economics of education, on everything from the impact of school resources, about the GED, about assessment and the achievement gap, about the teaching profession, who comes in, who leaves, who's successful at it, a whole line of research on the teaching profession. Professor Murnane's also written numerous very important books. I'll just pick on education and the economy. One of my personal favorites is Teaching the New Basic Skills, about how schools should respond to changing demands of the economy. He's also written fairly recently a book on methods called Methods Matter, Causal Inference in Education Research, which I highly recommend for folks from across disciplines, not necessarily in economics, but also in economics, who are looking for really applied, a great treatment on quasi-experimental methods in social science research. He's also a really unique scholar in that he doesn't just study education, but he also spends a lot of time in schools. One little unknown fact maybe is that Dick Murnane spent a year of his sabbatical working with the Boston Public Schools, trying to help them use assessment and data to become a better working organization to improve the outcomes of kids. And how we can, and in general, I think this led to a line of research on how we can better leverage data to improve schools and school districts. So most recently, I know he's working on a book on inequality, focusing on social policies that improve the lives of kids across the, at least the childhood spectrum of the life course. And I can't introduce Dick without mentioning what a wonderful teacher and mentor he has been to many scholars, myself included. So with further ado.
Thank you very much, Mikhail. After that great introduction, I should just stop right here. I mean, it's all downhill from here. I am pleased I don't have to follow Ron Haskins. Ron is those of you who have heard Ron speak know he's very humorous. It'll be a great show. So a very interesting, thought-provoking man. I'm going to talk about this paper that I wrote for the Journal of Economic Literature. It's coming out in a few months in that journal. It's also currently an NBER working paper, so it's available. I kind of like NBER rules, which means lots of interruptions. So if I go 25 minutes and nobody has interrupted me, I'm going to feel terribly hurt. That means you really were bored. So please do interrupt. Also, those of you who are graduate students, asking questions about data sources, I think, is really very valuable. I'm going to talk about three sources of data for measuring high school graduation rates. Each of these has challenges. I'm not going to say very much about the problems, but I'd be pleased to talk more about those. And there's also a section of the paper that talks about the problems in detail, because it turns out which data you use has a very big impact on what you find. Okay? High school graduation rates. This is a quote from President Obama from his State of the Union message in 2009 about the importance of high school graduation rates and not dropping out. Now, how do they compare to other OECD countries? In 1965, U.S. ranked first among OECD countries. It had the highest high school graduation rate. It now is below the OECD average. And it's not that high school graduation rates in the United States have declined. I'll show you that in a minute. In fact, they've increased over the last decade for reasons I'll talk about. But don't fully understand. I don't think anyone does yet, which is an interesting aspect for new research. The real story is that in many OECD countries have increased secondary school completion rates quite dramatically over the last 20 years, which kind of helps refute this argument, you know, we've done all we can, we're as high as we can go, we're kind of at a plateau. Other countries have done considerably better in terms of increasing high school graduation rates in the U.S. So another question is, why do we care about these things? Well, first, increases in educational attainment for the U.S. workforce have fueled economic growth and produced rising incomes. The best documentation of that, in my view, is Larry Katz and Claudia Goldman's terrific book, The Race Between Education and Technology. Well worth a careful read. The other reason that's particularly of interest to me is that education is the primary mechanism of upward social mobility in the United States. And throughout really all of the 20th century, economic growth was a rising tide that, in some sense, lifted all boats up until about 1970. And a key reason for that was that each generation of Americans had, on average, more education than their parents. How many of you have more education than your parents, educational attainments? It's true for me as well. And there's a nice paper in this volume, With Our Opportunity, that Greg Duncan and I edited, showing that the percentage that really has been a decline in intergenerational upward mobility, the rate of upward mobility in educational attainments in the United States, is by Mike Hout of Berkeley. And so this primary mechanism of upward mobility really is threatened by this stagnation in the high school graduation rate. Scott, thank you. All right.
So your last slide talked about graduation rates across countries. And so, do we have a good sense if what a high school graduate is the same across countries? And could the mechanism be it's getting easier to get high school diplomas in certain countries versus others? Are there any thoughts on or knowledge on that?
I don't really know, Scott. I've talked to folks at OECD. Andreas Schleicher, who runs that program, talks about the large amount of effort they put in measuring these things. I don't think that's the case, but I don't know for sure. So in particular, is it the case that they've changed the definition of high school graduation rate in particular countries, and that has contributed to this? It's a good question. I really don't know the answer. So, what are the other questions this paper addresses? First of all, how do you measure high school graduation? It turns out that's a non-trivial proposition. The second is, what are the stylized facts, so to speak? You want to explain, I want to describe six that I think are quite striking. Then, how can we explain these patterns? Then, of course, the question of, well, what are promising strategies to increase high school graduation rates? In other words, what's the evidence, the causal evidence on things that have been tried, and to the extent to have they made a difference? And then finally, a few words on, as we'll see, my answers to the fourth question about promising strategies is a pretty short list. And so the question is, why haven't the policy evaluations been more useful in guiding efforts to increase high school graduation rates? I'm going to talk a bit about that and basically make the case that the kind of interventions that are easiest to evaluate using the quantitative methods that help one to get tenure are not the interventions that have the most promise in improving high school graduation rates. As we'll see, that's kind of a problem I think that we as a research community face.
So what do you think is, you set up some reason why high school graduation rate is relevant. Do you think that for the rich country, the main role of high school graduation rate is because then some people will go on to college, and what really matters is the college graduation rate? Or is there something that, so there are, I mean, you mentioned the Katz and Golden paper. At some point, they make the point that in the modern economy, people who don't have an high school degree and people who have an high school degree are not so different. But what really gives you the boost is the college degree. So I wanted to know your opinion about why, or what would be the main reason to focus on that graduation margin? Is it per se or for the college?
That's a terrific question. I don't think that the Gates Foundation has it right in arguing that what the goal should be for everybody to get a four-year college education. I do think that to fare well in this changing economy, you're going to at some point in your life need more education and training beyond high school just because the economy is changing so fast. So I think what's really important is that you leave school with the skills to be a good learner going down the line. And I think for a lot of people, you know, we don't understand very well community colleges. I know Mikhail and others are, and Anne are thinking about that and studying that, is to what extent are particular community college programs important. I don't think we understand that very well. But at the same time, and I know the work David Carr's Eli lecture, where he talked about no difference between dropouts in high school. I'm going to show you some numbers in a minute on race differences by education that make me think it's a little more complicated than that. But I think you're just right, though. It's a good question.
So a related question. All your data and so on, is it really high school graduation? So you're not including GEDs?
We're going to have some slides on GEDs for sure. All right, that's an important question.
What are you thinking of? Are you thinking of high school graduation?
I'm looking at high school graduation rate as treating GEDs as dropouts.
Okay, fine.
Okay. It was clearly very important, the reason that you said. I mean, it's there are about 500,000 Americans who pass these 7.5-hour examinations, the GED examinations, and get this alternative credential called GED is the call. Okay, so how do you measure these? Well, it basically are three data sources. There are these, each of which is a problem, household surveys. So basically, this is the census, the American Community Survey, Current Population Survey, where they ask large samples of adults, what's your highest educational attainment? And you can so you can take the responses. Do they say it's at least a high school diploma? And of course, your question comes right in line, because you can't from these household surveys adequately distinguish GED holders from conventional high school graduates. There is a question now. It started in 2008 in the American Community Survey about if you say you are just a high school graduate with no post-secondary education. They do ask you if you acquired that status by taking the GED, but they don't ask you that question if you reported you had some post-secondary education, so it's incomplete. Also, comparisons of numbers with the GED testing service on counts lead ones to believe that the responses to that question aren't very accurate in any case. So that's one problem, is how do we take out the GEDs from the household survey? Okay, I'll talk about that. The second is the so-called Common Core of Data, you know, that the National Center of Education Statistics collects every year. It comes from school. Every high school is asked to report the number of individuals in each grade level, number of graduates. That goes to the district, that goes to the state, that goes to the feds. Is the most widely reported source of information, high school graduation rates. It's problematic for a reason, and I'll talk about it in a minute. Okay. And the third are these longitudinal surveys. Now, if you're only worried about national numbers, you know, you can look at the ELS 2002, the NLSY 1997, or go back and look at the earlier surveys. And I think they're not perfect. Jim Heckman and Paul LaFontaine have a 2010 paper in the Review of Economics and Statistics that points out some of the problems with these national longitudinal data sets. But I think most people conclude, if you only want national numbers, that's the best evidence. And you can separate the GEDs pretty well in those data sets. The trouble, of course, is you can't really go any more to a smaller geographical unit. Now, however, relatively new data source in most states are these state administrative databases that follow every student in public school longitudinally. And the federal government put a lot of funding, gave a lot of funds to states to help them develop these systems. And in principle, every state in the country now has the capacity to assess, to provide a number on the percentage of kids who are in public school who actually graduate, whether they do so in 4 years, 5 years, or 6 years. It turns out, I think most people thought this is going to be the way to overcome the problems of the Common Core of Data. I don't think that's true, and I'm going to show you why in just a minute. There's a real Achilles heel in these. And the Achilles heel comes back to, you know, the data ultimately come from schools, from high schools. And it turns out, you know, so they can count the number of graduates. I think let's for a minute argue that those numbers of graduates are okay. But the question then is, how about kids who left without a high school diploma? Well, you can, in principle, say it's a dropout. Or you can say the child simply disappeared. Or you can say the child transferred. And the incentives to count that the child transferred are very great because, quote, children who, quote, transfer are not in the denominator when you count the high school graduation rate. And we've got some data that I can show you if you want. I don't have it. It's a slide I've hidden. But basically, when you look at urban schools in Massachusetts, you see the percentage of kids who, quote, are counted as transfers relative to those who are counted as dropouts or disappeared is vastly higher than it is in suburban schools, looking at the ratios. So I think the problem is, so the federal rules are you're not supposed to count a child as transferred unless you have written documentation about where the child went. Now, if the child went to another public school, you could, in fact, follow them and find them, in principle. But if they go to a private school or they go out of the state, you're lost. And I think what our inference we make from Massachusetts data is the definition of written documentation is very vague. Cassie?
Are there differences? Like, if it's just to try and kind of fudge the data, you'd expect to see mostly in high school. Do you see any differentials in terms of the transfer rates, the differences between the urban and suburban in elementary versus high school? Does it just become super prevalent?
That's a terrific question, and I should look at that. I don't know the answer. That's really, let me Let me write that down. That's great. Yeah. Okay, so so what are the problems? Well, why does it turn out to be so hard for high school graduation rates? The real problem is these atypical paths through high school. Kids change schools, students being retained in grade, particularly the percentage of kids retained in ninth grade has grown enormously in this country, and immigration of teenagers. You know, what do you do about them? How do you count them? Some of them go to American high school, some of them don't. So and that's a real problem when you're looking at the household surveys. If you count recent immigrants, they may never have gone to high school in the United States. Do you want to count them in high school graduation rates? Well, it depends what your purpose in counting the graduation rates is. If you wanted looking at evidence on whether American high schools are doing a good job, you probably want to take them out. If you're looking about attributes of the labor force, you probably don't want to take them out. Okay, this is a chart that has way too many numbers on it, but let me just point out a couple of things. Now, so I know it's a bit too hard for most of you to see. What this is for kids who entered a Massachusetts public high school in the fall of 2005. And then the question is, what happened to those kids over the next 6 years? In other words, we looked in 2012, so where they had at least 6 years to graduate, and we said, what happened to those kids? And so one possibility is they could have graduated on time in 4 years. Another is they could have graduated, but it took them 5 years. Another is they could have graduated, it took them 6 years. Another is they dropped out, and there was clear evidence in the exit codes, they're dropouts. They reported as transfers. That is, they left the Massachusetts public high school, did not go to another Massachusetts public high school, but at the school level, they were reported to have transferred, meaning they went to a private school or they went to school outside the state. Okay? So that's transfers. Unknown is they simply disappeared from the database and without an exit code. They just didn't come to school one day but without ever providing information to know what happened to them. The last is, this is the U.S. government's definition of high school graduation rate, using their rules, and the key there is graduation rate in 4 years, but importantly, eliminating transfers from the denominator. Just a couple of points with all those numbers that are worth pointing out. One is, if you look, for example, at black males, you see, so 55 in Massachusetts, 56% of them are graduating in 4 years. But notice there's another 6.3% that are graduating in more than 4 years. So, the point is, if you are looking at black-white gaps in high school graduation rates or Hispanic-white gaps, the size of those gaps really depends upon how long you give kids to graduate. So 4-year graduation rates are going to have much bigger gaps than 6 years. And one of the things I think is a little crazy is that the rules that the federal government is laying out for how states are supposed to report high school graduation rates is they're supposed to report 4-year graduation rates. So at the same time, you've got increasing standards high school graduation rates. 75% of the kids in the country have to take exit exams. So they're raising standards high school graduation. And they're also saying all kids have to take these exit exams to graduate. But we're saying what really matters is that you graduate in 4 years. And this is really, I think, problematic, because in a lot of the urban high school folks we've talked to, they say, if we take kids who come in reading at ninth grade, reading at fifth grade level, we say, look, if you stick with us for 5 or 6 years, we'll help you to learn these skills to graduate, but it's going to take 5 or 6 years. So it's a little odd to think about having an accountability system that says 4 years. So another pattern here. So that's the first issue is, black white test score gaps, Hispanic white test score gaps are going to be bigger when you look at CCD data on 4-year graduation rates than they are when you look at household data of, say, 20-year-olds where they have more time to graduate. The second thing is, notice these transfer rates. So for Hispanics, you've got 16.3%. And notice it's very, very high. So what you do with those folks who count as transfers, whether you put them in the denominator or not, has a very big impact on the high school graduation rate for particularly Hispanics and to a lesser extent blacks. So those are just some details on how you measure these things. Heather.
Do those transfer rates, do they seem plausible based on what you might learn from the census about people coming and going from the state in general?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they're way too high.
Okay.
But notice, there's a problem, because again, when schools are under enormous pressure in some state accountability systems to increase the graduation rates, and if the Congress ever gets around to reauthorizing the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which is supposed to have done a couple of years ago, several years ago, at least the rhetoric coming out of the government is there's going to be more emphasis on high school graduation rates than there was in the original bill. So that's going to increase pressure to have increased high school graduation rates. So it's going to increase pressure on schools to count people as transferers so they remove them from the denominator. Now, to the extent that varies among states, it means that your estimates of trans high school graduation rates are going to be increasingly meaningless.
What could the transfers be? So this means they're lost to the state system. I mean, if they just transferred from one school to another, you'd still see
them. Then you'd find them.
So they've disappeared.
That's right.
And that means they either went out of state to get their education, or they dropped out. Is there any other
private?
Oh, private. These are state.
Good private.
Private schools.
That's right. So these are only public schools. So again, I think the big story is an awful lot of kids are simply dropping out, and they're being counted as transfers. I mean, that's mm-hmm. and you can think of, unless you want to put an auditor in every urban school, the cost of trying to get more compliance with the directive is going to be very, very high. Yes.
Might you be able to implement some sort of, I think in California we've called them, like, lack of student IDs across systems? If you had a better way to keep track of if a kid actually transferred because they had the same ID?
Across states?
Or even throughout the same state?
Oh, you can do it. You can follow them. In fact, most states, Massachusetts started this in 2006 or 2007, they say, look, if you say it's transferred and you say the child transferred to another public school, we're only going to allow you to count that if we find the child in another public school. Once they started counting that, reports on transfers went down a bit. But you still have this problem. See, if they've left the public school system, you don't know what happened to them.
What happens, for instance, in terms of counting towards the individual schools throughout that grade, or if a student transfers into an alternative education program from the traditional public school and then subsequently comes out?
It's the rules that are laid out in this 29-30 page 2008 federal guidelines are that the receiving school has to include the receiving public school has to include the child as their client. So in other words, and that's true even if the child were to transfer in the second semester of the 12th grade. So that's the rule that they're supposed to follow. Okay?
One small thing which you may get to later, but I'm curious if later you're going to talk about whether we think about it on time or 5 year or 6 year, how many are sort of leaving before the end of fourth year, like sort of are not present versus not completing the exit exam. So we think of dropouts as either they stop showing up or not getting the diploma because they're failing to pass the exam.
Well, in Boston, I remember the superintendent, Carol Johnson, has told me 40% of the dropouts have passed the exit exam, the 10th grade exit exams. So that's Boston, so I don't know beyond that.
So a very crude measure would be just simply if you had a good measure of the number of high school graduates to divide that by the number of kids who were in school 4 years earlier in ninth grade or whatever. Right, so that's not perfect. But given all these problems here, it might be a better measure.
Well, that's just what the common... That's just what the... Until fairly recently, until 2006, that's exactly what NCES did. That's ninth grade graduation rates. And am I going to show you why that... Yes, I am going to show you in a couple of minutes the problem with that. Okay. So the first kind of problem with this is that we saw kids have these funny paths through high school that creates difficulties in measuring high school graduation accurately. The second, as you brought up earlier, is this GED, the percentage of high school completers that is reported in household surveys that the high school completers were GED recipients is up around 12%. It's 15% among African Americans, so it's substantial. So how you treat GED recipients has a non-trivial impact on your estimate, particularly for particular subgroups. And again, the reason not to count for the high school graduation rates, as we know from work that Jim Heckman and co-authors have done, and we've done some as well, is GED recipients don't fare nearly as well as high school graduates in labor markets. And the explanation for that is quite interesting. It's not that they have lower cognitive skills than terminal high school graduates. Meaning high school graduates don't go on to college. In fact, you look at the distributions, we've done this in Massachusetts, of cognitive skills of terminal high school graduates and GED recipients, they map right on top of each other. But if you look at eighth grade school attendance records, the GED recipients are much more likely to have been absent. So the real problem is, and the reason that GED recipients don't fare very well is, you know, they have dropped out of school. Employers know that. Employers experience, you know, when you think of it, you're hiring somebody for an entry-level job. What's the first thing you most want? Come to work every day on time, right? And here you've got evidence that people weren't very good at that, at least a few years ago. So that's, I think, it's these differences in these, what Jim Heckman calls non-cognitive skills. My friend Larry Katz doesn't like that term because he points out, you know, it's all going through the brain in some sense, right? But, or you could, you know, so you need perhaps another term, but. Okay, so you really, if you're going to use household surveys to measure high school graduation rates, you really want to take out the GEDs. And we've done that. We were able to get GED Testing Service to give us information for the last 10 years on everybody who got a GED in this country, and we know what state and we know their demographics. So consequently, we can for fine-grained demographic groups, we can subtract off the number of GEDs who went to African-American males of a particular age and a particular year living in a particular state and for every other group. So that's what we've done is to get our estimates of high school graduation rates. Okay. Now, what are the stylized facts? The first is stagnation from 1970 to 2000. The Heckman-LaFontaine paper describes that very nicely. The second is, and this is this increased high school graduation rate between 2000 and 2010. And that's a really quite striking pattern, as I'll show you in a minute. The third is big racial gaps, and that I think are highly publicized, less well publicized, but equally true are these gaps by family income. Just huge. Okay, and if you put these three together, what do you see? And this is what you. These are Hispanics, these are African Americans, and these are non-Hispanic whites. And notice the remarkable stability, and this is by cohort birth year, so you could add 18 if you wanted to look at expected high school graduation year. You see remarkable stability. You see the race gaps, race ethnicity gaps, and then you see this quite substantial increase in the last decade. Now, NCES just reported an increase based on Common Core data just 2 weeks ago, and some people commenting on this said, "Oh, that's the effect of the recession, no jobs." But notice that doesn't work, right? In the terms of the timing, because notice the recession is 2007, and you can think of this as being 2010 in terms, because this comes from American Community Survey data. And so basically the increase started well before the recession, which began at the end of 2007. Hillary?
It's not the ACS, is it? I mean, it looks like it's precisely at the moment where the data store switches to the ACS in 2000 where the starts to look different. Do I have that right? In terms of when's your first ACS year that's generating that data?
Let me think about that. You're right. All these data points are ACS, but I had an answer to that question because I did think of that. Part of the answer is you see the increase in other data sets.
Mm-hmm.
You see, in particularly, there's reason to question the Common Core data, but you see it in those data as well. So that you really see them from two independent data sources. Also, we can match up. There was an ACS trial data set from year 2000. And we and others have compared that to the census numbers, and they're pretty right on the money. So I don't think it's ACS, but it's a good possibility. All right, so we've got three style effects. The fourth one is this large gender gap favoring females. The Golden Cats book points out this is not a new phenomenon. In 1920. The high school graduation of females was 7% higher than males, 1920. 1950, it was a 5% higher. But interestingly enough, in 1970, they were dead even. And now it's increased again. And of course, an interesting question is why? And there's an interesting paper by Marianne Bertrand and one of her students, Jessica Pan, in the American Economic Journal Applied, it's 2013. It's called The Trouble with Boys. That's got some interesting data that begins to shed light on this gender gap, which you also see in college graduation rates, not surprisingly. So the last two things are that the dropout rate appears to be concentrated in a relatively small minority of high schools. About 15% of the nation's high schools, and it appears to be great variation across states, variation that you can't explain, and not even half of by differences in racial ethnic mix. Now, these come from CCD data, because that's currently the only source of data by state. So I'm not 100% sure of the quality of these data. We're trying to generate state-by-state estimates based upon the ACS, and so I'll know more about that soon. Cassie?
I'm thinking about this idea that it is the reforms rather than some kind of societal trend type thing, and obviously...
Well, I haven't said that, right?
Well, no, but you said that NCES, or people who were quoted, suggested
right.
that. So I'm thinking about, how about the private school survey? Do you see similar trends in private school budgets? It's obviously a different...
That's another terrific idea. Terrific idea. Uh, um, The problem with that is it's a good idea. I mean, it's worth writing down. The only qualification I'd make is based upon the ELS 2002 longitudinal survey, the high school graduation rate of kids in private schools is 97%. So there's not a lot of room to move, but it's worth looking at from earlier surveys. That's a nice idea. So I'm not sure about these. Heather.
Before, I was just hoping you could say something about the change in the racial gap in graduation rate.
Yeah.
It looks like that improved.
You bet. It did. And that's, in fact, I'm going to end the last slide that I've got is kind of is a list of four questions that I think want to provide the agenda for at least my group's next steps on this research. And interestingly, though, you see, you're absolutely right, the black-white gaps and the Hispanic-white gaps have closed somewhat. You see that in ACS data. You don't see it in the Common Core data, and I think there are two reasons for this. One reason is the Common Core data are only counting four-year graduation rates, and we saw that a significant percentage of blacks and Hispanics are taking longer than four. The other thing is, following the Heckman-LaFontaine, we began with taking the Heckman-LaFontaine numbers and being sure we could, in fact, implement their methodology and get exactly the same numbers. Then we updated it, and then we used to follow their exact methods in the ACS. One thing they do is they exclude our recent immigrants from the analytic samples. So anybody who came to the U.S. after the age of 11 are excluded. The idea being that they wanted to focus on what's happening with some sense the ability of high schools to get kids through. A lot of these kids, about 3 out of 5 immigrants who came to the age of the U.S. after the age of 11 are Hispanic. And among those aged 20 to 24 in 2010, of those recent Hispanic immigrants, only less than half have a high school diploma. Now, whether they came to American high school and didn't graduate, or whether they never went to an American high school, you don't know from the ACS. But the point is, it makes a big difference, because if you include those, it's going to affect graduation rates in California, in Texas, in New Mexico and Arizona a lot.
This narrowing is in levels, but if you think of it in proportion of people who drop out and the percentage change in that, then it's much similar. It's roughly about 25% improvement in the dropout rate for both. It's a little bit more still for the minority. But if you just view this as school of at-risk people, now we're reaching 25% of them, then it is more similar.
Okay. Fair enough. Okay. All right, so we've gotten up to here, I think. So these are the patterns. And now I want to turn to what are the explanations for these? Now, my training is in economics, and this was a paper written for an economics journal, so it won't surprise you that I focus on the economic, the kinds of variables that economists think about. And first is, what's the payoff to high school graduation? This is going to come back to your question there. The second is the opportunity cost. Some of you may know this early work by Dan Black and his colleagues, very nice, where they looked at the coal boom in western Pennsylvania in the 1970s, and the net effect is the coal boom led to a significant increase in the high school dropout rate because there were good high-paying jobs. Then when the coal boom turned to a coal bust, the dropout rate declined. So there is evidence from other people's work. Whether that plays a role here, I don't think so in these recent trends. So third is this rate of time discount. Again, since this basically is, how patient are you? So it might be that there's good economic payoff in terms of lifetime income streams to getting a high school diploma, but if it means you have to go to school now instead of working for pay now, and if you're a very impatient person, you might decide that I value the income now more than in the future. So the question is, does that play a role? And after thinking about this over and over again, I was reminded of a paper in the Journal of Economic Literature by Becker and someone else from about year 2000, pointing out that in some sense, rates of time discount are endogenous, to use the kind of economics term. That is, they're influenced by a variety of things, including the way children are growing up. And in fact, I mean, we have increasing evidence on early childhood experiences in affecting kids, patients, affecting a whole variety of kids' personality characteristics. So in some sense, that's not a separate variable, I think, in an economic terms in this context. And the last term is this non-monetary cost of completing another year of high school. Now, that turns out to be quite important in this story. Now, if I were trained in sociology, I would be breaking up this fourth one into about a whole bunch of different subcategories, because this is, you know, peer groups, school culture, all kinds of things that are the realm of sociologists. I tried to read a lot of that work, but I put it into one category. Okay, so what's the evidence here? So on the predicted payoff, if we simply look at, this is current population survey data, and if we simply look at what are the constant dollar trends in mean hourly wages for high school dropouts, high school graduates, and four-year college graduates, we see, in fact, if you look very, very closely, this is a speck wider than that, but not much. It's a bit wider than that for the females. But it looks as if the payoff to high school surely didn't decline and seems really quite substantial. So this is kind of partly response to this question of whether, if high school graduates, if high school graduates are completely interchangeable with dropouts, you wouldn't see this pattern, I don't think. Now then, if you look...
Sorry, the change, I mean, if you think about, has this change in the last 30 years, then there is a significant change in the position of college, but not the other students.
Fair enough, I agree with that. For males...
For males, yeah.
For males, yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you put in a fourth line, which is some college group, because you were talking about, you know, it's not access to a college degree, but maybe a little additional training. Do you see anything?
Not much, but again, you know, the trouble, particularly since they changed the census, you know, what, in 93, I think it is. So there's this problem of, you know, what do we mean? So I agree, it's interesting. I thought about that, but I couldn't figure out a definition that I found comparable. Now, what about if you break it out by race, ethnicity? And basically what you see here, so these are ratio of high school dropouts, high school graduate mean hourly wage. And with the exception of this odd pattern for Hispanic males, notice for all the others, it's downward sloping. So although high school graduates didn't do wonderfully between 1980 and 2008, the relative wage of high school graduates relative to dropouts was better. That was dropout, the ratio of dropouts wage to high school graduates rates declined for all male and for all female groups and for all males except for the Hispanics. Now, so when you look at that, you might say, gee, it doesn't seem, if we want to explain this stagnation, high school graduation rates, from these data, it looks as if, there was a pretty good return to graduating from high school. So maybe we should look a little further. Now, one story you might say is, you know, you're only in the sample from which these numbers are generated if you're working. And so this is always the question, you know, economists worry about, was selection bias out of the labor market? And we know, in fact, that the employment to population ratio for dropouts has declined enormously, particularly for males, and if we looked at black males, it would be even more precipitous. So the question, this is a point, you know, again, Jim Heckman has made, is, you know, you might think there really is a, you, when we look at this prior picture, these are averages, but it might very well be that for kids who are entering high school with pretty weak skills, there may not be this kind of payoff, and that's why they drop out. So that's the possibility. But then you got to ask the question, how do you have the one literature that says, you know, heterogeneous payoffs, high school diploma, that it's not going to be much benefit for kids who have very weak skills. Say. That's one story. But then you have this so-called compulsory schooling studies that at least the economists among you know. You know, there are several of them. Phil Oreopoulos has done. And basically, those are studies in which researchers used changes in school leaving requirements. Typically, states or whole countries increase the number of years of schooling, increase the minimum age you had to attain before you could legally leave school. So they use that as the kind of a source of exogenous variation to ask this question, does completing another year of school buy you anything? And of course that's the methodology they use is focusing on these kids who are right on the margin, who would have liked to have dropped out. And the payoff to this extra year school is remarkably consistent. It buys you 10% extra earnings across these studies. So you got to say then, how do you fit these together?
Both of those studies are based on variation from significantly long time ago.
Yes. Phil has one. In the book by.
Phil has one using more recent.
Yeah,
I don't remember enough about that one to know.
It's in this NBR volume edited by the health guy at MIT.
But in general, the literature is based on variation and
fair enough.
Very early right. So it could be that there are differences in those returns.
Right. So, but I think the Dixon, let me ask, how many of you know what instrumental variables are? Okay. All right. Some, but not all the grad students. Okay. So this is.
Again, I didn't look to see. I think people over there should have raised their hand.
I see. So here's the story to reckon. So the question is, can you fit together the finding of the compulsory schooling studies and if we believe Phil's recent study. How do you fit that together with Jim Heckman's idea that really for kids who are coming to high school, not really with very good, solid cognitive skills, that high school diploma might not buy you much? And the story, I think, is, and this is an insight Kevin Lang, who's a terrific labor economist, provided, is, but think about what the instrumental variables for how it works is you're using the instrument, the change in the school leaving age, to predict number of years of completed schooling, and you get exogenous variation in that you then use to predict subsequent wages. Well, the striking thing is that for a lot of kids, increasingly in recent years, staying in school another year does not lead to another year of completed schooling. And you see this, so as a result of which, They're not influenced. And you see this if you look carefully at Phil's most recent paper, and you look at the coefficient in the appendix to that paper in the book, the first stage equation, you don't get a statistically significant impact for blacks. So for blacks, the rule you have to stay in school for another year did not lead to an increase in the number of years of schooling completed. So you see this looking at, this is Massachusetts data. So this is the percentage of Massachusetts first-time ninth graders who repeated grade 9. And notice urban low income. More than 1 in 4 kids are repeating grade 9. Then you ask the question, among those who repeated grade 9, what percentage of them graduate within 6 years? And what you see is, for urban low income, it's 30%. So in some sense, failing to get out of grade 9 in 1 year means for a lot of these kids, they're not going to graduate from high school. So that, so I think that's the key, is the reconciling the compulsory schooling studies with this idea of heterogeneous effects, is there really isn't any conflict, because for a lot of these kids, being required to stay in school for another year did not lead to an extra year of schooling. And the reason what drives this, a lot of it, is the kids aren't passing their ninth grade English and math. That's a piece of it. And or their high schools want them to stay in ninth grade so they don't take the 10th grade exit exam and fail it, because they're worried about failure rates. So I think, so this is a key piece of this fourth explanation, which is the changes in the non-monetary cost of getting a high school diploma. 75% of the kids have to take exit exams. Many states have passed increased laws having increases in number of English and math courses you have to pass, science courses you have to pass. So there really is increased requirements for getting a high school diploma, and that affects certain groups much particularly, you know, and they're the urban low-income kids and minority kids particularly. Okay. So, let me see, Ron. Now, I should be done by when, Mikhail, or Marianne? All right. Okay, so let's see kind of where we are here. So there is a, as you know, starting in the mid-1970s, a lot of states increased high school graduation requirements. They basically were, the rate of economic growth slowed markedly with the OPEC oil crisis of 73. People said, well, we have this malaise, the slow growth. And as is in the case throughout the nation's history, when there's a problem, let's blame it on the schools. And so basically the argument was that the labor force isn't very good. It wasn't a good argument, at least at that time, but it did lead to introduction of minimum competency tests. Then in 1983, publication of A Nation at Risk led states to increase graduation requirements, more English, more math, and that became standards-based education or test-based accountability in the 90s. And then, of course, No Child Left Behind in 2002. So there really has been an increase in high school graduation requirements. And there are a substantial number of papers. We've done some. Sean Reardon's done some. Paco Mattarella Rand has one. That have tried to look at the consequences. And basically, the question is, did the increase in standards, particularly introduction to exit exams, did that have a negative impact on high school graduation rates? And the answer is, if you assume a common effect on all groups, is no. But if you look more carefully at the vulnerable groups, you look at urban kids, you look at the low-income kids, blacks and Hispanics, you see the answer is yes, on most studies. So I think...
major state-by-state variation?
Oh, yeah, because... yes, but there's no study that I know about that's looked across states, except the RAND 5-state study. And I think the studies that have plausible strategies for making causal inferences...
that's what it is. It's the methods, right? Rob Warren's stuff did look at cross-state differences.
That's a good point.
And looked at the differences in the state, whether the minimum competency exam or more standards, and find some dropouts. But it's not as rigorous, I think, of a sort of causal test.
Can I get the reference now?
Yeah. All right. So basically, I think part of the story for the stagnation in the face of pretty strong economic incentives to get a high school diploma was, it became more difficult to get a high school diploma for kids on the margin, for the most vulnerable groups. The other piece of it is this increasing role of the GED. Jim has a whole series of papers on this. The most recent one that I know about is Taking the Easy Way Out, the Journal of Labor Economics in 2012, where he summarizes the result of research he and his group did on three natural experiments in three different states where there was a change in the ease with which high school students could get a GED, and he's shown, again, with differences and differences, strategies, that increasingly making the GED easier to get led to an decrease in the high school graduation rate. Okay. And the percentage of 16 to 18 year olds that got a GED increased quite dramatically beginning several decades ago. So I think that's another piece of it and of the story. Now, so that's the story about the stagnation. But then we get the question is, why these, the standard high school graduation rate haven't declined in the last decade. I mean, the exit exams are all still there. So why the increase in the last decade? And that's what I want to turn to next. But
what about the quality of the curriculum in high school? Is there evidence on what, unlike the intensive margin, what is required as a learner? So I understand there are new tests and new courses required, but within those courses, are they getting harder over time?
Yeah, there probably are people in the room who know that better than I do. We do know from the NAEP transcript studies that kids are taking more science and more math now than they were 30 years ago. Now, but that doesn't... The question is what's in those courses. And that, I think, is more difficult to define. So I don't know the answer beyond number of courses. That's a good point. Now, so explaining the increase. I gave a talk, I guess at the New York Fed, about a year ago, and an economist named Joydeep Roy, who had done some interesting work on high school graduation rates, he pointed out, well, if this is real, if it's not Hillary's ACS problem, if it's real, then shouldn't you see this in increase in National Educational Progress 8th grade scores at the bottom of the distribution? That is, because we know 8th grade test scores are pretty good predictors of high school graduation rates. So if this is real, shouldn't we be seeing an increase in the 8th grade NAEP scores? And it turns out, you do. This is math, and this is reading. This is 25th percentile. So we haven't done all the quantile work that you and Marianne have done, Hillary, but we've done a little bit looking at low. So if you look at the 10th percentile, you see the same thing. Why look at the bottom distribution? Because, of course, they're the kids who are most likely not to graduate. And you see in math, so these are white, these are non-Hispanic whites, these are blacks and Hispanics, and the 25th percentile, and we see beginning about the late 1990s, substantial increase. And for reading, it's a bit more complicated because you get this big decline in reading scores, particularly for blacks. But you do get an increase starting in about 1995. So now that doesn't tell you, of course, the same question is, why the increase in high school graduation rate? Well, why the increase in these 8th grade NAEP scores? We still don't know the answer. But at least it's somewhat consoling, I hope. But maybe Hillary doesn't find that.
I don't want to nitpick dates here, but just so I understand, that the x-axis here is the year they're taking the test, right? So it's the 8th grade year.
Yes, right.
And what you were showing us before, I'm just trying to remember what it looked like, was looking at... It just seemed like this is starting too early, I guess is what my recollection of the prior graph is.
Well, let's think. So here we've got 8th graders in 2000, Yeah. Increasing. So they would have been 12th graders in 2004. So, yeah, it would be nice if we could have pushed this back a little bit.
I'm now seeing the connection. Right. Yeah, the timing.
So, why the increase? Well, of course, it was interesting to hear the pundits speaking a couple of weeks ago when NCS released these numbers saying, oh, high schools have gotten better. Our schools in general have gotten better. They may very well be right. But boy, it's been very hard to, you know, produce good evidence on this. So it may be that we've actually improved schooling for struggling students. And I think it makes sense. God knows we've been trying hard at that for the last 30 years in particular. And then maybe we've made some progress. So that would explain the NAEP. But there are these other things that are important to keep in mind that are changes in kids' circumstances outside of school. So one is, for example, the fraction of four-year-olds in classroom-based preschool increased from a third to a half over the last 20 years. So, and we know early preschool is a good predictor of a number of things. So that's one trend. No causal evidence here, just patterns. The other is, and this is the striking thing, the birth rate among 15 to 17-year-old girls declined by 44%. Among African-American teenage girls declined by 60%. Now, that could matter for two reasons. One is teenage girls who bear children often drop out to care for the children. And second is the children born of teenage mothers don't fare very well on average in American schools. So for both those reasons. But of course it raises the question.
Why did that change?
Exactly. And if anybody has any good evidence, the only paper I know on this is Melissa Kearney and Phil Levine. It's an NBI working paper. And as they point out, they're using state-to-state variation. They don't do very well at all explaining this trend. So it may very well be that there's
STDs, I think, is part of what the demographers think is going on, is the growth of STDs that just raised the risk of, and so more use of condoms and so on, I think.
Okay, well, that may very well.
Less than Phil's work, but that's what I... Case study journalism.
Right. And another story, the arrest record of teenagers, arrest rate of teenagers for violence-related crimes is way down. And again, that's probably perhaps a little bit easier to explain through increased policing and things. But so we've got lots of things happening to kids outside of school that could play a role in explaining this. Of course, we get lots of things happening within schools, too. But, of course, that varies enormously from state to state and school district to school district and even school to school. I've not been able to find any good causal evidence to explain this quite substantial increase.
Could I give a labor market explanation? So, first of all, it takes a while for people to assimilate what the difference is in terms of their future earnings. Right? So as economists, it would take a long time to figure out differences between high school dropout and graduate salaries. The 1990s was a boom time, right, under Clinton. And that may have delayed it, so the high school dropout could get to us. You showed us the employment population ratio declined actually in 2000. Quite substantially, right? And it may have been hard, to get out of high school and get a job. And certainly, youth employment is much harder to find now in general. So I just wonder whether the change would have happened earlier, but for the Clinton boom, and then the inevitable change happened, with the Bush recession.
That may be. What we're trying to do now, as you see the last slide, is we're trying to put together state-by-state graduation rates. It's tough to do for a bunch of reasons I could talk about, but the question then is, will we see enough differences in these labor market conditions across states and over time that we could explore some of that? Yes?
It seems to be the experience of the parents that they have getting employment with their level of education that impacts the way they raise their kids. And say you're going to stay in school or you're going to school.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's
right. Children have development of the cognitive skills, but the parents have experienced the challenges, and they transfer that information to their kids. Because we're not going to have, you're not going to have as many kids as I did, for example, or whatever, as an example.
But you think, but I that's plausible. I would kind of ask Hillary's question about timing again, because you know the a lot of the increase in the college high school wage differential is the decline in earnings of the high school graduates, particularly males. You know, the 1980s high school graduate wages declined a lot. So that's 1980s. So I mean, you may be right.
You have to think about when the parents of the 80s kids were being raised, because the 70s, the economics were challenging. I mean, there were some real hefty increases in the price of petroleum. I remember, I mean, I saw that, and I was like, wow, it was like 35 cents a year, and then it went to this, and then it went to that, and now it's, and those impacts on kids, on the way they raise their kids.
Yeah, that's a nice idea. Yeah, maybe. Any other ideas, Scott?
Well, Brian, Jacob, and Tom D, and then Handcheck has some papers looking at school accountability systems, using the variation in the timing of school accountability systems, looking at NAEP. So I don't know if they actually looked at the NAEP for eighth grade at the bottom end of the distribution, but it'd be interesting to see if the timing of those eighth grade test scores at the bottom end of the distribution are correlated with state accountability systems.
I agree, and I want to affect talk to them about sharing data. But, you know, my reading of the D. Jacob paper is not a lot there, right? I mean, you know, it's a good paper. I mean, they're very talented folks. But in terms of did accountability, the introduction of accountability play a big role in increasing test scores? I
guess my curiosity is at the bottom end of the distribution.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
On a related point, I haven't thought this through, but what about, isn't this the time period where we're telling schools don't retain kids? It's bad taxes to retain kids. I haven't thought through the sort of, so then if, you know, if they make it sort of in California, at least there's other folks who can assess the kids who are still showing up in their fourth year were harder to sort of not graduate because they're still showing up. Now they didn't sort of depart sooner. So you had more kids just sort of not being retained in ninth grade. I mean, it's not consistent with some other stuff. Just think of, but it was a time period, I think, when we suddenly told schools it's a bad idea to, I mean, at least in Chicago, and thinking of those types of papers, this is about that same period.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that ninth grade retention grew dramatically in the 80s and 90s and has not abated. Pardon me?
I think this was in the urban schools. It really slowed down in the 90s because of evidence that kids,
ninth grade retention rates?
At least from the stuff from the Chicago School Consortium.
Well, let's. Oh, I should look at that.
Because we had a lot of evidence that those kids were dropping out. So, one, I mean, not that it's a great solution, but we just didn't retain, right? So.
Yeah. Okay, so we have more hypotheses than we have data to explain these. But you'll see, that's kind of where I want to try and go next. How about effect? I'm going to finish in 9 minutes on time. So how about what do we know about effective strategies? And again, I wish this were a stronger list. Like everyone else, investments during children's early years are clearly important. Both the neuroscience evidence is quite compelling on this, and of course we have the evidence from Perry Preschool. But again, you know, Perry Preschool had a total of 121 people, including four crossovers in that sample. So very small, but I think increasingly the evidence is getting kids in preschool earlier. We heard this in the State of the Union speech a few days ago is important. The Raj Chetty's and his colleagues' paper, NBR working paper, on the importance of effective teachers in affecting long-term outcomes, not a surprise to any parents, but, you know, quite striking evidence. Improving middle schools and high school quality. There's a number of now papers, David Deming's work from Charlotte Mecklenburg, the MDRC studies of both career academies and small schools of choice suggest that improving high schools make a difference. But The other piece of this is when you look at these high school interventions that have been evaluated well, for example, the small schools of choice that, you know, Joel Klein closed about 30 of these very large comprehensive high schools in deeply troubled areas, schools that had graduation rates of about 35-40%, and they had an interesting competition to start new small schools. And so MDRC did this evaluation, and the results show 10 percentage points increases in five-year high school graduation rates. That's the good news. That meant from 65% to 75%. So you've still got one in four kids not graduating. So yes, you don't want to give up on high schools, but boy, it's important to get kids to enter ninth grade with the skills to do high school work. So the other thing about the GED, you need to reduce this crowding out effect that Heckman and his colleagues have written about, possibly raising the minimum age to 18, that's been talked about. But you know, there's a funny pattern we've just seen in the GED test score data that I'm hoping we can look at is, among GED recipients, the percentage of those who are 16 to 18 increased dramatically from over the last three decades, up until 2007. But after 2007, it's declined quite precipitously. And I don't have a clue why that's the case, but I'd like to find out. That's nationally.
Can I just ask another question?
Sure.
Have military requirements changed over time in order to get the military? So, for example, does the GED do it? Do you need a high school?
Not anymore. Other than they were taking some GEDs when they had a lot of people on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. But typically, with rare exceptions, the military is not taking GEDs.
There's high school graduation.
High school graduation.
There's uncertain times for a lot of poorer kids and so on. A way out is to go into the military.
That's right. And that's not an option. The other thing that I'd like to learn more about is, most GED preparation programs are pure test prep. And they don't do much in the sense that they don't help kids to acquire these skills that employers are looking for. The reason the programs look like that is there isn't much money for adult education and they're cheap. There are very few programs. LaGuardia Community College has one. They try and have real curriculum to try and teach some of these young people some of these skills they need. Because one of the parts, and the story GED preparation folks tell you is, the classes, the kids they get in their classes are these 20-year-old males who left school at 16, an absolute mess. And they floundered around, if they got work at all, for 3 or 4, 5 years. Then they met somebody they wanted to make a life with. And the woman told them, why? No work, no money, no nothing. So they'd like to shape up. So they go looking for work seriously, but when you fill out an employment application, you got to put down your employment history. Well, you never get interviewed once the employer sees all these blanks. So these young people are looking for a way to signal something better. But the regular GED programs, the test prep, don't seem to be doing much for them. And so the question is, would more serious interventions make a difference? Scott.
As a father of two boys, a lot of this policy, you see boys falling behind. So it seems to me the penalties are just massively steep for 16-year-old kids who make bad decisions. If you graduate from high school, you can go back when you're 30, 40, 50 years old and go to college if you want. But pretty much there's no mechanism to go back once you've dropped out to get a high school degree. Is there any...
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
Why is this the case? Or any policy movement to open up second chance high schools?
Well, there are a lot of them. I mean, there are many. I mean, New York has a whole bunch of them.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of urban districts.
Did you actually earn a high school diploma versus a GED?
Well, there used to be a lot more. I mean, there used to be a lot of adult high schools, evening
right.
schools.
Yeah.
And there's a woman named Lois Quinn who has written a chapter in this book that Jim's doing on GED that basically says the introduction of the GED program drove out these adult high schools because they cost money, really, to run those. I think it's a real question. As you know, the evidence isn't very good. This National Guard challenge, youth challenge, is kind of encouraging for kids. But you know, the bigger problem is, you know, this paper we were talking about earlier this morning by Bruce Western and a colleague. You know, one in four African American dropouts is incarcerated before the age of 35. One in four. So if you think about a stigma, so, you know, so that enormous. So let me, I've got 1 minute to finish up here. So basically just a word on these evaluations. You know, when you think about, when you think, you know, IES is, you know, funding now literally hundreds of randomized control trials. And if you think about trying to set up a randomized control trial, and it's a lot easier if it's a very modular intervention. For example, there are lots of interventions. We're going to have kids go to an extra math class designed for an hour a day. So that's easy to bring about because you just got to hire a teacher and you got to assign kids. But the evidence on these, and there's been literally dozens of evaluations of these modular interventions, they don't do much. Of course, it's not much of a surprise, right? When you think about kids' lives, you're changing them for an hour a day, but all the rest of their lives are pretty much the same. So then, in contrast, when you think about how might you really intervene and make a difference. Well, particularly speaking at the high school level, it's very tough. You really need to, and there's a nice example that New York Times had in an article on the front page about 18 months ago, Brockton High School, which is the biggest high school in Massachusetts. It's an immigrant community. There, a small group of teachers said, "We got to change this school. It's a horrible place." And they met on Saturday. And after two or three years, they met a small group and they said, what we really need to do is we need to have writing across the curriculum. The kids need to be writing in phys ed, in art, in everything, because our kids are doing horribly on the state exit exams. So they had this idea. Then they tried to sell it to the faculty. Well, then they took 3 or 4 years to push out the teachers who didn't want to do this. Well, but I mean this. So over 7 or 8 years, they really transformed the school in a very fundamental way. Well, think about what the RCT for that's going to look like. First, they didn't know what they were going to do when they started to meet. It took them 2 or 3 years to figure something out. Then it took 3 or 4 years to get rid of the folks who didn't want to participate. And another couple of years to implement. Now, ultimately, it made a huge difference. But it's very hard to think about designing an RCT that would allow you to look at this. So the problem is the kind of interventions that potentially change kids' experiences every day, all day, which are what I think have the potential, take a great deal of time to figure out and are very difficult to evaluate. So I think we have a real problem in designing research that meets the high causal standards we all have, but that also has the potential to help kids. So let me just conclude with these are the questions we talked about those. So this is where I want to go next is, you know, I want to use some state-to-state variation to see whether you can make progress in understanding these increases, particularly the increases for blacks and Hispanics. These gender gaps, why are they so large, particularly among blacks and Hispanics? Does that vary across states? Can we use differences in accountability systems, as Scott mentioned? As many of you may know, 45 states have signed up for these Common Core state standards that are coming down the line in 2014 and with assessments to match. How is that going to impact high school graduation rates?